Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. This series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Sophie Ganek, assistant professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. We will be talking about her book, Dispossession and Dissent, Immigrants and the Struggle for Housing in Madrid, recently published by Stanford University Press. Thank you very much, Dr. Ganek, for joining us today. At the New Books Network, we like to start by getting to know our authors. So could you tell us about your background as an urban scholar and how did you conceive of this book?
Thank you for having me on the podcast. And I'm delighted to talk about the book. So I kind of as a teenager into college was interested in urban issues and then also started doing research on and in Spain. And I did a whole undergraduate project on the urbanization of Madrid under the Franco regime, some of which actually makes it into this book. And so like, yes, your useful research adventures can sometimes, you know, come out in print many, many years later. And then, you know, I was so taken with Madrid that I lived there for 3 years after I graduated from college. And it was right in the moment of the Spanish boom, kind of this period between more or less 2000 and 2008, in which there was absolutely rapid urbanization projects taking place and just the kind of wholesale transformation of the city as it was really becoming a major European capital. And it was at the same time that, and really, you know, because these kinds of urbanization projects needed labor to build them, that you saw this huge influx of immigrants. And so Spain, basically, in the course of under a decade, goes from having under a million foreign-born residents to over 5 or almost 6 million foreign-born residents. So it's a very massive and kind of qualitative and quantitative shift. And it was at the same time that I was living there and observing kind of how difficult it was to get a house and find a place to live. You know, I was a renter and yet everybody was buying, but the prices seemed extremely high. So I wondered, you know, as you see this kind of emergence of a new immigrant class, how, where, and, you know, by what means these kinds of, this new population was finding housing within. The question of housing is central to you know, just how we live in, I mean, that sounds redundant, but like how we can kind of survive and thrive in the city. And so I was observing these kinds of transformations taking place with the knowledge that the housing market, you know, just more or less from a kind of anecdotal perspective, and then from my own perspective as a renter, realizing how fraught the urban housing market in Madrid was, that when I went back to graduate school, I was thinking, you know, I knew that I wanted to do some sort of project that looked at immigration and housing within the Madrid context. Then I was doing pre-dissertation field work and really intended to do a whole other project that was on migrant squatters in the city in June of 2011, which was, I got to Madrid, you know, about a couple of weeks after the occupation of the Central Square and the beginning of the what's called the 15M movement, which was this massive kind of outpouring of activist and, you know, populist energy. And very soon after I got there, this question of evictions emerged. And it was actually on, I think it was exactly 10 years ago tomorrow, on June 15th, 2011, that the anti-eviction movement in Madrid blocked the first eviction. And it was about 500 people showed up to prevent an eviction from taking place. And the eviction was supposed to occur, the household that was being kind of defended in that moment was an immigrant household. The man was a Lebanese baker out of work, and his wife, also out of work, was Bulgarian. And so I wasn't there, but I read about it in the newspaper, and I remember thinking, that's the story. There's something going on here. First of all, how did this, you know, very modest household, you know, kind of working class immigrants be able to afford an apartment that in a kind of explosively expensive urban property market? And then what was going on that you see this huge outpouring of popular support in an effort to keep a family in their home, keep an immigrant family in their home, right? Which also goes against the kind of common narrative of rising xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment in a time of economic crisis. And so it was from there, that's kind of the seed that then, you know, I began to follow as I made my way through my PhD and then, you know, and through an extended period of ethnographic field work.
That makes perfect sense. And I want to ask you a little bit more about this immigration side of the story you describe in your book. So in the book, you develop important critiques of the integration discourse accompanying immigration debates. And as you do so, politics and lived experiences of housing and debt provide a critical lens for you, which, you know, comes across beautifully in your answer to my previous question. So can you speak to what housing and debt tell us about immigration and integration in Madrid and beyond?
Sure. So, you know, I look at the project of integration as fundamentally a political project, and a political project of kind of crafting immigrant subjects into, you know, or kind of bringing immigrant subjects into some sort of idea of the mainstream or of the dominant culture. And in many ways, the way in which it's conceived of politically and by policy actors and statecraft is A, deeply politicized, right? And B, can be somewhat divorced from the reality of everyday life, right? And so it becomes about certain variables and programs as if they existed in a vacuum. And here, obviously, I'm glossing over a lot of very nuanced and important work that's been done on the integration of immigrants, particularly in a European context. But I think fundamentally, first of all, a lot of immigration is, migrants are coming to cities, right? Just as we're all, becoming a more urban society across the globe. And so we have to then think about the settlement of immigrants within these kinds of urban contexts as occurring against broader landscapes of and cultural currents that affect how we all are living in and working in cities. And I think contemporarily, and we certainly see this now with COVID and discussions of emerging from the pandemic, that housing and unequal housing markets and landscapes are, very much shape the outcomes of people's daily lives in cities. And this is true if you're, a native member of the working class, if you are an immigrant, even if you're, a member of the ostensible middle class, that we're all in one way or another struggling to find adequate and affordable housing. Related to housing, of course, is the question of finance. And you have somebody like Raquel Rolnick in the Sao Paulo scholar of housing and former UN rapporteur on housing discussing what she calls the empire of finance that kind of shapes our housing landscapes. And so it's also these questions of credit and debt and extraction that very much shape everyday life. And so we have to understand the kind of trajectories of immigrants and their processes of settlement as being very much shaped by and conditioned by questions of housing and it's, its financial entanglement.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, in one aspect of the book that I appreciate is how you show us that consent for that is actively produced by political actors. And, doing so sutures home ownership to being a good migrant or successful migrant. So can you tell us how good financial subjects or good migrant subjects are created in Spain? And what does the process by which homeowners are made tell us about urban governance and liberal democracies?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think I'm going to kind of disarticulate mm-hmm. it a little bit. First of all, it's a question of homeownership, which I was trying to resist the urge to just describe or analyze these actors as kind of caught in some sort of grand scheme to wrest equity from mm-hmm. them, right? That I wanted to understand what were their own aspirations and wants and desires that were prompting them to become homeowners. I think critical scholarship in particular, and those of us on the left can be kind of dismissive of that urge to become homeowners. And really, actually, as I got deeper into my analysis, I realized it wasn't just, people weren't buying houses just because they had some sort of dream of, the little white picket fence as we think about in the United States, but it's actively related to their own kind of calculations of financial risk and reward and an idea of a future return on investment that it seems, and part of this too was my trying to understand how it was that a, no money down mortgage for a 200,000 euro flat was a sound, was perceived as a sound financial investment. Because it's very easy for us either to think of the immigrant or even the member of the native working class who's making that decision as either a dupe being fooled by the system, or as, you know, the right wing rhetoric would then be that, oh no, they're taking advantage of the system. But it's neither one of those explanations actually illuminates anything, right? And so within the particularities of the Spanish case, one of the things I talk about is the fact that, you know, in Spain, there's basically no, well, we might have our own kind of stereotypes of, you know, sand, sun, and sangria, right? And bullfights as like being part of Spanish culture because of the fraught nature of historical Spanish nationalism. There's not one vision of the kind of model citizen. However, there is this overwhelming predominance of owner-occupied housing as the dominant form of housing tenure. You know, when in the 2000s, it was over 80% of people were living in owner-occupied homes. So it's kind of like that's one thing that you could point at that is, say, typically Spanish and is deeply enmeshed in Spanish culture and also in you know, forms of investment and forms of economic growth, which, of course, as I talk about in the book, emerges out of a very particular historical trajectory of planning and policy. And then, you know, all of the attendant ideologies that around home ownership, around saving and, you know, being able to make monthly payments and being able to care for a home. And so all of those then also get kind of activated around the idea of the immigrant homeowner, as the immigrant homeowner, as this kind of, as somebody who is able to kind of take on the responsibilities and obligations of being a like kind of productive member of society. And that's being, you know, on the one hand, that's kind of being sold via financial and real estate industries, but it's also, you know, very much interpolated like with ideas that migrants have or immigrants have about what they want for their future in this kind of new society in which they're living. And so the idea of like, what is the good immigrant subject becomes wholly allied, at least in Madrid, with the kind of homeownership project. But again, as I talk about a little bit at the beginning of the book, like homeownership in a lot of different geographical contexts is very much seen as a sign of kind of full integration or assimilation and permanence. And so it's by no means, that's by no means a Spanish story alone. With regards to kind of liberal democracy and urban governance, I mean, homeownership, I mean, like the US context, for example, homeownership is so integral to our political, social, and kind of cultural ideas that we have about ourselves, and is also very much ingrained, like very much tied to a vision of a kind of capitalist liberal democracy as, you know, creating these kinds of, as creating kind of good capitalist subjects, right, who are responsible for his or her own plot of land and property, and that investment in property and will make him or her into kind of a good neighbor and a civically minded, responsible citizen, right? And there are others who've talked about this. There's a book called There's No Place Like Home by Brian McCabe, where he's talking about the US context. Property ownership and home ownership has now become kind of a major export across the globe. In the Spanish case, there are particularities to the history of Spain under the Franco regime that give rise to the home ownership model, but it becomes also then very much allied with a model of capitalist growth under a totalitarian regime, and is again seen as integral to the production of like good. I mean, first it's good subjects because they're, you know, people are under a dictatorship, and then in the democratic era also as integral to like kind of making European citizens. And there too, you know, while we talk about home ownership as being part of, you know, creating responsible citizens because they care about their own immediate environments, they it's like, I respect your property rights so that you respect mine. And you know, so much of the language of property rights is really, really integral to the US political order. But we, you know, it's also fundamentally about integrating people into markets. Mm-hmm. And in a moment in which you have declining and unraveling social safety nets, particularly with the rise of austerity in Europe, but also just longer histories of deregulation and disinvestment, you know, the investment in a home is the primary means by which we secure kind of social reproductive needs, whether it's, you know, the common adage of like using your house for as an ATM in order to pay for unexpected healthcare costs or, you know, children's educations or other kinds of goods and services that have traditionally fallen to more robust welfare states. The house really is, you know, has all these multiple meanings, and not just kind of symbolic or metaphoric, but also very much tangible and economic. Yeah, does that answer the question?
Absolutely.
I don't know. I went in a lot of different directions. And, you know, and what I will say, too, is like the subprime crisis in the United States, we also have this, you know, it's hard to talk about this book in some ways without, you know, as a U.S. author in a U.S.-based university, it's hard to talk about this book without making some reference to parallels in the United States and the subprime crisis that occurred here. You know, we also have the idea that that foreclosures were, you know, against people who were buying multiple big mansions mm-hmm. in the Sun Belt or something. But in fact, the vast majority of foreclosures were taking place, you know, often women, people of color, older people, and it was, they were for refinancing mm-hmm. and refinancing, you know, your mortgage in order to pay for exactly what I've mentioned, like unexpected healthcare issues, caring for old people and, or, you know, paying for college for, you know, a young adult, that it wasn't some sort of greedy urge to buy up as many properties as possible, but rather just kind of meeting the demands of everyday life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks so much for this answer that covers, you know, so much geographic depth. And, you know, as I read the book, I know how it speaks to sort of context other than Spain, but now I'm really glad that our listeners will get to know how it relates to the US, for example. And my next question is sort of about what happens after debt or after or in the process of home ownership. So you show us that for Andean migrant communities in Madrid, lived experiences of debt and dispossession result in civil death, which is, you know, a term both you and they coin. So could you explain what civil death implicates, and what is at stake in painting this broader picture of disposition through this term, and showing us how debt shapes people's subjectivities and lives as a whole?
Yeah, so, you know, many scholars have discussed the ways in which debt and indebtedness is kind of woven into so much of daily life, whether it's, you know, student loan debt and paying for college or homeownership, or most recently, like, there's a group of scholars in my department who is they're studying debt amongst post people who've been released from prison, and the way in which debt kind of becomes a condition of extended networks and very much kind of conditions what life after prison is like. And so debt shows up basically everywhere you want to look. It is fundamental to our contemporary society. And of course, it's like, we have personal debts, there are municipal debts, there are national debts. All of these forms of debt produce our contemporary society, essentially. But I wanted to, so, you know, in talking about civil death, it was a category that people were talking about, were identifying them, you know, for themselves. And what I realized was that, you know, indebtedness and the process of dispossession, which we can think about as an economic process, right? It's something that results from signing a mortgage contract and from handing over your euros to the bank. But that it goes so far beyond just a simple question of like how much money I have in the bank and what my kind of financial future will be. Instead, it is something that really extends into so many different aspects of life. And so the elaboration of this category of civil death is an attempt to reckon with the very violent nature of, and kind of insidious nature of, indebtedness as it transforms relationship, you know, kinship relationships with amongst family members, friendships, also your relationship to kind of society as a whole, and thus, you know, thus meaning that the process of losing one's home in this case, we can think of other processes of indebtedness and dispossession, really kind of transforms and in many cases kind of brutally wrests the debtor from his or her kind of everyday milieu, and is such that it has very specific consequences, and often along lines of, you know, race, class, gender, that is very punitive for those who kind of suffer through this category. And I think, I mean, it's a way, you know, there's been such a shift to the kind of financialized subject that it's a means of understanding how that the consequence, you know, basically the kind of human consequences of that shift, that it means that, like, going broke, going into debt is such a transformative and, you know, a negative process.
Civil death is also a socio-spatial condition, you tell us, a condition that fixes migrants seeking home ownership in place while demanding mobility. So can you speak to the paradoxical mobilities that home ownership creates?
Yeah, I think home ownership is a deeply paradoxical system. And this is precisely one of the reasons which is paradoxical, in that, you know, it fixes, in this case, it fixes somebody in place, but the demands of keeping one's home and being able to pay one's bills and you know, not losing one's home to the bank demands a lot of hustle and drive if you're not, you know, just kind of independently wealthy. And I see this now, you know, I see this with my parents who own a house in San Francisco, which you know, they were fortunate to buy in the 70s at a low price, which means also now that they're kind of locked in because of strangenesses in the California tax property tax code, where all around them is like changing into this kind of, you know, techno dystopia, like extreme gentrification. And then, but, you know, a house requires a lot of maintenance and, you know, a lot of redoing the siding and replacing this. You know, my parents have been in this long process of replacing a skylight that was leaking, and all of these kinds of, all the labor that goes into the house, which is part of the, our kind of, one of the reasons why we have this ideology around home ownership is precisely because of, you know, the ideas around labor that it also enacts. And so you are then tasked with all of these other kinds of chores and little jobs and, you know, scrounging up the money to pay for the repairs or, you know, in the case of like a New York apartment, the co-op fees and, you know, that it's constant work, right? It's not just retreating to your nice home and hanging out, right? And then in the specific case of my immigrants in Madrid, and I think, I mean, this is the case in a lot of places and for a lot of kind of lower middle and working class homeowners, you're often only able to buy in places that are far away from centers of employment. And so there's then this trade-off of, you know, you might own your own home, but you have to spend more hours commuting. You have to, you know, you might not be able to afford to buy in amongst the community of your own people. And so, you know, while there's kind of this illusion of permanence and stability and fixity, right? There is also then this whole kind of geography of movement and mobility that is necessary in order for one to have a house and maintain it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really important to think about. And yeah, I love that you point out these tensions between fixity and mobility. Another part of your work that I found particularly powerful was your chapters on the refusal of civil death. And you show us that repertoires of political action from indigenous struggles in the Andes deeply informed the refusal of civil death in Madrid. So how does indigenous politics travel to Spain and translate into political action and solidarity against dispossession?
So, you know, in the case of the immigrants who I work with in Madrid, it's a case of quite literally members of indigenous communities, you know, who'd already been faced exclusion and expulsion from native homelands, you know, first often moving to Quito in Ecuador, and then because of failing financial markets in Ecuador, moving to Spain. And so, you know, it's the case of indigenous, quite literally like indigenous people moving to the former metropole, Madrid, and bringing with them their particular traditions of activism and political engagement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here, I think, we have often there's this kind of idea of the flaneur activist who's, you know, like the anti-globalization guy, often it's a white guy, right? But there are all different modes of political action and engagement that kind of travel from one place to the other. And you know, it's also that in those movements from one place to another, people encounter other forms of discrimination, marginalization, dispossession, right? And so, you know, there's a process by which, you know, that just life experience gives one a kind of arsenal of knowledge. And then, you know, because of other traditions of activism, they also have an arsenal of resistance. And so what I talk about in the book is essentially that this community of Ecuadorians, who many of whom were indigenous and had been involved in indigenous struggles in Ecuador and in the broader kind of Andean world, saw what was happening and saw, you know, their own risk of foreclosure, and realized that this is essentially, you know, similar practices of extraction and in some ways neocolonialism that was producing similar kinds of results and, you know, objection and marginalization that they had faced in a very different, you know, in a very different context. And so, you know, as one of my interlocutors says, you know, she has seen no place on earth where, like, getting organized around an issue hasn't produced some kind of result. Mm-hmm. And so that to me was really powerful, that, you know, it is, and that is a lesson too for housing movements and housing struggles and precarity in many different places. I, you know, in New York City, my cousin is a housing attorney, and she, in my class on housing, she talked to my students about, you know, I, as an attorney in a courtroom, can only do so much. What's really going to do something is if the tenants in you know, get organized against their predatory landlord. If you get together and you start organizing and you make those kinds of connections, and often it's laborious work, it's not, you know, change is not going to occur immediately, but that's what produces results. And so it's this kind of, you know, a kind of embodied experience as somebody who's fought against different forms of predation that really influenced a response to the problem of foreclosures and evictions.
That's really wonderful, and I think that's a great takeaway for, you know, our listeners who themselves might be facing, you know, similar issues that are really pertinent around the globe and not just particular to Spain. I want to shift gears a little bit and discuss your methodology. Can you take us through your ethnographic fieldwork? And how did your ethnography enhance your understanding of disposition and activism? Or what were some challenges you faced during your ethnographic fieldwork?
Oh, man. First of all, there's so much that doesn't make it into a book. All of one's, like, frustrations and anxieties. And
that's what we're interested in this podcast.
Yeah. You know, I spent on and off over a year and a half with the platform for people affected by mortgages in Madrid. And first of all, I got there when it was a very hot issue. It was a very hot collective. There were a lot of people coming through wanting to, you know, do some sort of research on this movement, but it often to me made me a little bit uncomfortable, because people would come and have like a weekend to do some sort of mini project, and it would be like, we'd like to interview, you know, an immigrant woman, preferably a single mother, about her experiences. And so it's kind of like, oh, wow. You know, on demand. And so I made a choice early on that I was just kind of initially going to hang out and, you know, obviously be upfront, like, I want to study you guys, but I'm also here and I'm willing to help in whatever capacity I can. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I did English language translations and stuff. And then I really kind of wanted to just get to know people and get to know the work that they were doing. And this before I ever even asked for an interview, right? Like just show that, you know, because, and it really, it's also, I was intrigued and engaged in their struggle, not just because I had to write a dissertation, but because I was genuinely just, you know, very inspired and also curious about how they were succeeding in this very kind of hostile political climate and preventing people from losing their homes. I think, you know, it's hard. Any kind of process of ethnographic immersion requires, there are periods of boredom, there are periods of frustration. There's inevitably a period of where you're kind of stumbling along blind, too afraid to even kind of really step a toe into what is your field, so to speak. And then there are, you know, there's so much that doesn't make it into this book. And a lot of that is very endemic to activism and kind of politics, like interpersonal conflicts, conflicts in competing forms of activism, which I talk a little bit about in the final chapter. And I have an article that came out about 5 years ago in Society and Space that does more, is more an attempt to draw out some of the conflicts and contradictions of different modes of activism. But some of that is just like, some of that is just inevitable. And then I realized that this is a lot of it's background noise and it's not important to the story that I want to tell. And that doesn't mean like you go and invent the story you want to tell, but that there are inevitably other narratives, other kinds of tangents that one can go down, but that might not be the most fruitful sources of and sites of analysis for the kinds of questions that I was asking.
Mm-hmm. So. I love how you point out, you know, particular challenges of studying urban contexts that are in demand, so to speak. You know, as an anthropologist who conducted fieldwork in a, you know, quote unquote over-resourced study, I also, you know, witnessed a lot of people demanding a certain kind of interviewee on demand. And I really appreciate that you pointed out the importance of really, you know, valuing moments and participating in overcoming social problems that are of interest to us and maybe go beyond interest. So I really appreciated that. And, you know, I also love your approach to archival work sort of in this thread. So you tell us in the book that you created an archive of advertisement that promote home ownership, as well as documents and flyers that activists used. Can you tell us about how archive making emerged as a research practice for you? And how did this process figure into your work?
Yeah, so way back when, I was a baby historian. My undergraduate degree is in history. And while there were a lot of things that I didn't love about my undergraduate education in history, I did love and think that it provided a really robust training in archival research. And so I knew, you know, I resist the urge, which can be very present in urban scholarship, of a lot of presentism, right? Like these kinds of situations emerge from lengthy histories. And particularly in the case of eviction, which I mentioned, I think, in the introduction of the book, like eviction is the punctuation of a much longer process. And so it needs to be kind of historically situated. We need to understand what has happened up to the point that means that evictions are taking place. And then, you know, part of my effort to understand the climate of immigrant, the acquisition of homes. And having lived in Madrid in the same moment, I was cognizant of there being this kind of entire kind of political and cultural economy of acquisition. And so it's like you can rely on what people tell you, but I knew that there was more out there that might kind of flesh out the realities of what it was like living in Madrid in 2005 as an immigrant. And, you know, because inevitably you're like, well, how do these immigrants even know to buy homes? Where do they go? What is, you know, what's going on? And so I spent the better part of a month in the National Library of Spain with the archives of Latino, which was a free weekly newspaper that had very large circulations in Madrid as well as Valencia and Barcelona. And I looked through every single issue that I could find that was, and these are not well-kept records. And in fact, I've talked to the publisher of that newspaper, who also, like, they don't have very well-kept records of their own archives. And so it was a process of just sitting there and kind of making notes and also surreptitiously taking little photos of images with my iPhone. And investing the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, so much of research, I think, to do good research, you have to dedicate a lot of time to things that may or may not bear fruit. And in this case, I had a fairly good idea that was gonna provide something pretty interesting, and it did. So,
I agree.
And one of the big things, and I will say, the big challenge then was when the book entered into production, I had a planned trip to Madrid to get proper reproductions of these images. And because of COVID, it was just impossible. And I had a kind of long and very frustrating back and forth with the librarians there. And and so some of those old iPhone pictures have made it into the final book.
Wonderful. I'll be looking back at the book to see to see which ones made it. Lastly, what is next for you? What are some new projects or questions in which you're interested currently?
You know, so this project really clarified for me an interest in kind of the role of urban property in shaping our social worlds, right? And I think we've seen that in the last year in terms of COVID and the disparate outcomes that are brought about by just highly precarious and insecure housing systems, whether it's in New York, in outer boroughs like Queens, or in places in the global south, in India or South Africa. And so I have done a little bit of work and have been toying with a project that's specifically about kind of immigrants and housing insecurity in the age of COVID-19 in Madrid and New York. In part because I feel like I'm particularly well situated knowing a lot of the grassroots infrastructures that exist in Madrid and having gained a little bit of familiarity with the New York landscape too. But I'm actually kind of about to embark on a new project that emerged at the end of this book, where, you know, so much of this book is the ways in which homeownership can go completely wrong. And in my life, and I mentioned my parents and their house, In my life, homeownership has actually like been an incredible source of stability and now wealth, because my parents bought a house in San Francisco in the 70s. Never, you know, who expects that then 40 years later, it's going to be worth just huge amounts of money because of gentrification mm-hmm. and the primacy of investment in real estate. And so I've begun to do this project that's actually kind of on my parents' generation of homeowners who are largely like artists, writers, the kind of bohemian Californians who were making San Francisco their home in the late 70s and early 80s. And their relationship to kind of questions around NIMBYism and gentrification and the kinds of politics that is produced through homeownership, and then also like its paradoxical outcomes of having been able, in their case, like having been able to secure some sort of intergenerational transfer of wealth, but it's also at the expense of kind of a concomitant intergenerational transfer of like community and urban sociality, right? My generation can no longer have, you know, we can't be artists and writers and bohemians in San Francisco in the same way that my parents were and are. And so that's been a source of kind of this recent line of inquiry that also is interested in the kind of transformation of San Francisco but, you know, having written a book about Madrid and having invested so much of my kind of intellectual curiosity in Madrid and looking back at some of the stuff I've produced, I'm like, wow, I know so much about this place that it seems like I'll have to go back there and do more work there at some point too.
So. These are all very exciting. We're all looking forward to, you know, the books or articles or whatever comes out of these new projects.
Me too.
Great. So thank you very much, Dr. Danek, for joining us and your insights. I'm your host, Aliza Rujan. This discussion of dispossession and descent, immigrants and the struggle for housing in Madrid, published by Stanford University Press in 2021, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.